good game. Let's get into it. Righto, Money Miners. Gold, gold, gold. As Chloe said the other week, gold's going off its head. Not the gold price, the gold news.
Gold news, mate. There's so many gold reporting.
How good is it?
That's good. I wish there was more of those Remelius numbers popping about, though. Just the big cash builds.
Yeah, I know. What was Evolution's free cash flow yield of 0.3% or something? anyway, that's copper.
Let's give a preview. What do we got, Matty?
Trav, take us on a bit of a gold journey, mate.
We're going to go around the grounds for all of the gold reporting that we saw today, because we got quarterlies from Bellevue, we got them from Genesis, we got them from Tieto, we got it from bloody Catalyst late last night. And then, mate, the biggest gold story of them all, Spartan raising $80.
$80. Jesus Christ. And technically sort of raising 110, but we'll get into that.
So, mate, I'm excited.
And we've also got a bit on AIC. I saw you jumped into them, Trav.
Yeah, mate.
A1M.
They do produce a little bit of gold, but it's in concentrate with the copper out at Eloise there. They put out their quarterly and updated resource and reserve today. And then, mate, you got to sneak in some Gina every day.
Couldn't leave that out.
Right, let's start with bloody Bellevue. Boys, what's going on?
Well, Matty, I want to take you on a fast journey of the Goldies, okay? So let's first stop Bellevue, which, if you don't know, is a 40-hour bike ride from Perth. Now, look, according to Google Maps, that is 40-hour bike ride from Perth. Yes, and Jada, you're the cyclist amongst us, so get pedaling, mate.
What are we waiting for? Let's go.
Bellevue, much anticipated quarterly from them. Tumultuous day of trading of the stock as well, because they were hammered on open, down from $1.90 to $1.70, and then they clawed it all the way back to sort of close up about 3% for the day. They're hovering just below that sort of $2 mark.
So someone lost open money at the start, and someone made a shitload at the start.
It's
bloody phenomenal.
Yeah, I don't know how to explain. I think it just. It's really interesting, hey, like how, when you see that sort of stuff happen. But nonetheless, mate, let's give it what we think happened with Bellevue today, because this quarterly has been eagerly anticipated because there's still mixed views out there about Bellevue in the market. Some say they're on the home straight now. Others say the raise is inbound. But they produced 37,300 ounces in the quarter. The most important thing to see with Bellevue is that head grade is climbing. In the month of December, remember it was 3 grams a tonne. That has continued to rise month on month. It's now at 5.8 grams per tonne. But to the cash flow, because that's what we look at, the cash flow, Bellevue absolutely get the award for the most baffling waterfall chart of the quarterly season. Hands down, I was expecting to give this award to Red 5 as usual. But this time, it cannot be topped by Bellevue. This is a bloody strange one. The gist of this is, I'll flash it up on screen, but the gist of this waterfall chart, when you look at the cash flow quarter on quarter, the cash balance actually fell from 44 million to 21.5 million. So ordinarily you think they're in trouble, right? Not quite, because they paid an invoice to develop and some other creditors which related to the prior quarter. So they're grouping $17.6 million of the cash outflow in this quarter as pertaining to the prior period. So don't include that. Now,
yep.
If you take their word for that, we'll be generous, then they only lost $4 million. Is that how it works? Not quite, because if you look at this waterfall, they include the value of the bullion that they built up over the quarter two, and they want you to kind of picture it as, you know,
ready liquidity to sell.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Which they say grew by $40 million and they had $18.5 million of bullion on hand at a quarter end. So, after all that gymnastics, they suggest that they are making money, kind of. No wonder Australo is checking the gold price every day. But look, I do think it's a bit cheeky to show things this way. I like to see my waterfall chart start with the cash balance that you started with and end with the cash balance that you ended with. And of course, they're at like, yeah, it's, you know, you can articulate the elements that you think are non-recurring and those sorts of things. But I think,
Trav, did you think when you opened the announcement straight away, in the subtitle already, there's an asterisk or a footnote on the very first thing? I think it says something like 20 million free cash flow with a footnote straight away. And my first suspicion is they're trying to do some signaling. They're putting it so far up the top of the front, the first page, that like that already set the alarm bells off to go running down to see what the numbers actually look like.
Mate,
I don't know if that was just me.
Mate, you read the first page first in quarterlies?
My mistake.
I
don't even read them anymore.
You need to know what they're signaling. Yes. You need to know what they're signaling.
Oh, suppose if you go like like quarter on quarter, like last quarter. Last quarter they had a payment still to go out the door for develop, which is, I don't know, what are we attributing to that about? Is that the 17.5 or maybe a bit less?
I think there was a little bit more of infrastructure chucked in at 17.5. So it was like around 10.
10 and 15. Yeah. Okay. And then, bloody, this quarter they're saying they've got 18.5 million of bullion ready to go. Let's just cancel them out. They've spent about 23 million this quarter if you take they cancel each other out quarter on quarter.
Yeah. I think the market's going to be forward looking, right? And they're going to say, okay, so 20 million bucks cash. Right now, plus some bullion, which is, you know, could help them out, and that grades climbing, are they past the hurdle? And I think the reason you get this like buddy mental gymnastics in this waterfall chart is because the company is clearly trying to signal as much as possible that we don't need to raise money. Mm. We're good. Trust us.
If they don't raise and they get through this, bloody, that's going to be a big bloody pat on the back because they're bloody close.
Yeah.
They're very, very close to needing to. But if they do get through it without doing it, that's going to be a pretty good bloody effort, I reckon.
I saw a little bit of marketing that Stralo's been doing. I'll play a snippet of it for you, Matty.
We're just ramping up to full-scale production. We're setting up for a really strong financial year 2025. We've got through the bottom of the J-curve. We're putting free cash flow in the bank. Yeah, so look, huge 12 months ahead of us. You know, we're through the difficult part of the build, you know, if you call it the risky time in the mine life. And, it's just about following the plan and delivering, you know, high quality ounces, a lot of cash flow into the market. And, you know, it's really going to set us up for, you know, a decade to come.
So, I mean, I honestly look at the numbers, I look at the marketing. I think I'm looking at everything and I kind of think, okay, they're trying to persuade us that they don't need to raise money, that they're past the hurdle. And you know what? I actually believe them at this point in time. I think everything is signaling, you know, the worst is over. That's not to say they're not fragile though, because
one operational fuck up.
Yeah, one operational fuck up can change things. But if you have the bloody buoyancy in the gold price that you've got right now, you've got grade climbing. Yeah. I'm sort of in the camp of they're on the home straight.
Yeah, yeah.
Matty, we still good for a carton, mate? I'm pretty sure you'd bet that they would raise by the end of this quarter that we're in now.
I said July.
July.
All right, we'll do July. That's
good. So I've got until July. I've got a couple of bets going.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Alrighty. Yeah. Looking forward to seeing how. I think my
thesis was if once they got into the GDX and there was potentially a bit of a rise on the back of that, and they say they got to bloody $2.50 and they were still a bit skinny on cash, that they would use the value of that to raise a bit of dosh. But I know they won't want to because they'll want to get the re-rate on the back of delivering a project without raising. So
yeah,
but we'll wait and see.
One more thing on the hedge book too, just while we're on Bellevue. So like these companies with significant hedging are worth looking at now that the gold price has rallied again. I don't think never before have we looked at Bellevue's hedge book and thought, ouch, until now, right? And it's because gold has rallied so much. Mm. So their average hedge price is it's nearly $1,000 below spot at the moment. I think it's like it's mid to 700s, which until recently didn't look too far away, but that's now, you know, over $200 million out of the money. So I think we should do a follow-up episode where we just reevaluate everyone's hedge books and just sort of think, fuck, it's a good problem to have because it's out of the money because gold price has gone up. But anyway.
Next you're dead up. Right. Their average hedge was 2780.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they did those hedges. They hedged a bit, locked a bit in for these couple of quarters before the gold price got up and probably just – and that was – I think that was above the spot price. They locked it in above the spot price at the time, but gold's rallied so much, so it has burned them a little bit on the short term.
Yeah, they actually do include a chart that shows the whole hedge profile, which I like, by the way. I'd love companies to do more of that. Don't just give me your buddy averages and over time. I want to see the full profile, which is handy.
So there's good detail in the hedge book chart, a bit too much detail in the waterfall chart.
The waterfall, mate. I was like, what's going on here? Anyway.
Lots of detail everywhere. It's good.
Clearly.
Alrighty, Genesis.
Next stop, Genesis. So Gwalia, mate, it's only a 10-hour bike ride south of Bellevue. Get pedaling, really? JD, mate. Just
JD.
Yeah. I reckon we can do it quicker, but we're not that far.
Me and Trav will get an Uber behind you, mate, and stay at the bloody pub for a bit.
You can go ahead, just break the wind.
Genesis produced 30,400 ounces in the quarter, which is actually 5,000 ounces less than the quarter before that. So, you know, production ounces gone down. If they put out another quarter like that, they'll kind of hit the low end of the production guidance for FY24 of about that 130,000 ounces. Operating cash flow was skinny, just the $2.4 million gain on that front. But of course, they spent some money on the Kin projects. And they're investing some capital at the same time. So quarter on quarter, the cash balance actually fell $21 million. But like Genesis, they still got that healthy $169 million cash in the bank. And we all know this phase is about setting them up for the future. They're still underfeeding Gwalia Mill. So 237,000 tonnes was processed in the quarter versus nameplate of 1.4 million tonnes per annum. So I think the key takeaway with Genesis is just it's too early to judge them. Yeah, we've got to keep waiting. But we'll keep waiting with keen eyes, Matty, because we love Leonora.
Question I have is, and it's not as simple as you put it, but when they're mining such a deep ore body, it is high grade, but it's deep, and it only gets deeper and more difficult.
Mm.
I know there's personnel to think about and cost to this, but do you think they should have just turned the mill off for a few months or something to build a bloody stockpile so they could actually fill the Gwalia mill with this above 5 gram dirt coming out of Gwalia? It's hard to, you got people to think about and the cost associated with it, but
yeah.
I don't have an answer.
It's an interesting question to pose. I think they had all these third party agreements as well. So you kind of have to
add to keep it going.
There'd be a bunch of severance costs, which would be pretty the severance costs associated with all that sort of stuff are probably way bigger than we think in our heads. Yeah. But
Yeah,
exactly what I was going to say. I don't think it would have been economic to do it for such a short period because you're paying people out for months and it's it doesn't buy you any goodwill when you're trying to be the heart of Leonora. So
yeah, exactly. I think it'd just be a frustrating spot to be in where you, because once you're taking that high grade out, you're just getting deeper and depleting. But if it was that simple, I'm sure it was done. But anyway, that is what it is in the old district of Leonora.
Final destination in WA. I've got one more after WA, but final one in WA is Plutonic Gold Mine, which now you got to backtrack a little bit here, JD. I know your legs are sore, so sorry about this one. It's only 26 hours simply by the pushy if you go north from Gwalia. We're talking about Catalyst, of course, Catalyst Metals. So they're they've got two small mines. So Plutonic's not their only one. They've got that plus Henty over in Tasmania. They produced 28,000 ounces of gold in the quarter, and their change in cash was pretty neutral when factoring in debt repayment. Now I actually kind of hate it when you see these small miners get away without needing to put up the cash flow quarterly. It shits me. I know they're allowed to do it because of some IFRS thing or whatever, but I want to see the cash flow, actual cash flow statement, not just the activities quarterly.
100%.
So anyway, they've got no commentary on the hedging change, but it looks like they added to their hedge book about 20,000 ounces for June at 31.70, which is out of the money at spot price already, obviously. The 51 million bucks that they had in trade payables was the number that had me a little bit nervous when they put out their half-year results not too long ago. And these quarterlies, they obviously don't provide colour on trade payables or anything like that, but there's lots of talk in this one for obvious reasons. I noticed Argonaut initiate coverage a week or so ago. So I think it might be touch and go if the running gold price will see them generate enough free cash to clean up the balance sheet or if they'll try and tidy it up with equity so that overhang is removed. And Gina's been selling a position. So fun fact for you, Hancock has been on the register of Catalyst for ages, but back when they were this Victorian gold play, this exploration sort of had all this Victorian gold ground when everyone got excited about Victorian gold.
Where is that from? Was that Superior? When was she in on it?
She was Catalyst Metals. They were just this very illiquid but heavily valued like explorer that was like a $200 million market cap back in 2020, and it didn't even have a mineral resource yet. It just had a bunch of ground that everyone got excited. Well, some people got excited about because there's this renaissance in Victorian gold excitement post Fosterville. And anyway, obviously since then they've picked up Henty, they've picked up Dangoan Superior, and, yep. and now they're a small scale now miner.
Catalyst, yeah.
And you can see in the disclosure today, Gina's, she's been sort of dripping her stock out since the start of the year. She's gone from, you know, 6% ownership to just north of 5% ownership. And so there's a bit of an overhang there too, probably.
Yeah, righto. Interesting. That's one of her bigger plays, eh?
Oh, I don't think she's too concerned with gold anymore, is she? Yeah. Not that she ever probably was, but yeah.
Yeah, right. Okay, let's see where are we up to in the bike ride now.
So, JD, after 76 hours total on the pushy, I bet you wish there was a better way, mate. And I know you're a cheapskate too. So, but you'd be pleased to know, JD, you can actually fly there cheap too. You've just got to use Brooks Airways.
Brooks, that's saving me.
That's 76 hours on the bike, mate. More like 4 hours in the Learjet, maybe less. Not quite sure. Anyway, time is money, mate. So you gotta just, this is savings. You gotta think with your head, not your wallet. And you know who else has figured that out? These guys, according to LinkedIn, they have FIFO flights scheduled to Mount Gibson each week. Now,
I saw destination.
Yeah, I looked at the LinkedIn page. I couldn't quite figure out if it was Mount Gibson, the Mount Gibson, the company going to Coolin Island, or if it was someone going to Mount Gibson Gold Project and it's Capricorn. Anyway, whoever it is, they're smart people, smart operators, because they're figuring out they can save a buck, do it simply. They don't need to ride push bikes, JD. And anyways, I also looked into Brooks equipment hire today, and I had to count how many categories, not types of equipment, categories of equipment they had. Guess, 10, 20, 30, 40, no, 50.
50
categories.
Jesus, that's fucking flying out the door.
Including my favorite category, the portable building category. See these dome shelters? That's where you park the Learjet on site while the aircraft hangar is still in construction. You can also throw, you know, bush tufts under them, everything, mate.
You could have a bloody mine site rave if you want to. That's bloody brilliant, Trav.
I think we should hit up Brooks for a mobile podcast studio to take on the road. So look at all these bloody mobile building solutions.
We could have one set up. And look, we've got the bloody, you know, I like to go to the shitter every few hours, so we can bloody get one of them there.
Mobile hydration station, mate. You don't want to run out of water.
Oh, mate, bloody, they should start a beer. Brooks Kegs. Oh, brilliant, bloody brilliant work, Trav. Righto, Trav, good luck riding to this joint, JD. Tieto.
Get into Tieto. So we spoke about them. Geez, I think it was on Monday, fellas, and a bit's changed since then. So the quarterly's come out today, and as well they have given their recommendation on the updated takeover bid from Zhao Jin. So their board has advised shareholders to reject the revised offer. So we spoke about it the other day being upgraded or revised from 58 cents to 68 cents. Now the stock's trading at 64.5 cents. So the rationale was largely similar to what they'd said 6-odd months ago when they rejected the first takeover offer. And that was, you know, undervalues the company. The timing's pretty opportunistic. It was even more so back then than it might be now. The gold price has materially increased since that bid. You've got the net liquidity being the company actually making a bit of money recently, having significantly improved. And there's still too many conditions, even though Zhao Jin did what they could to address that. So given the bid is best and final, you know, they can't come back for a while. So it's sort of back to the drawing board for them, pending a few other details.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you're following the Seven Group's like offer for Boral recently. Not quite a mining deal, but
no, it was, mate. Yeah.
Yeah, so that was best and final, and then they came back and rejigged it in a way where clearly there was a better deal. It involved a bloody special divvy and all this sort of stuff, but I don't know, mate. Best and final is like not best and final.
A lot of coverage in the West Australian on that deal.
Yeah, I heard the guys on the Chanticleer potty, and I think it was James Thompson just say it made a bit of a mockery of the best and final, you know, slapping that on an offer, given that they were able to sort of tweak things in and around it. But there's a few other details to play out. So in that first rejection that they did 6-odd months ago, They were pretty bold in saying that the two major shareholders who spoke for almost 19% of the stock rejected the offer. But then, you know, you read through today's and you don't actually see any mention of these major shareholders. So, you know, I'm not sure what to read into that, but that remains to be seen how they're thinking about it and how they view that increased attempt from Zhao Jin. And then takeover aside, you've got the quarterly that came out today and things have been sort of slowly and steadily improving there. They produced 37,000 ounces at an all-in sustaining cost in US dollars of $1,330. Cash and bullion improved by 6 million to 89 million. That's in Aussie dollar terms. They also paid down 10.3 million in debt, and that leaves them with just 10 million left in debt.
That's pretty good, bloody not a bad cash bill, cash and bullion improvement.
Not bad at all.
Effectively, that what they made more money than Bellevue Genesis. Just yeah, this is Tieto, mate. West in Africa. Just yeah, this is
in Africa
much more substantial cash build.
Things are meant to get better as well. They're adding, you know, they're upgrading the crusher, so that's meant to go from 4. You know, whatever they're doing now, 4.8 ish million tons per annum capacity to 5.5. And if you look at the other aspects of the quarterly, the grade was 0.99 grams per ton. That's meant to improve this year to over, on average, 1.2 grams a ton. And recoveries, they hit a record at 95%, so pretty respectable there. You look at the life of mine plan, this was a sort of big deal. It was completely reshuffled when it came out in October, I want to say, of last year. And 2024 is meant to be a pretty good year in terms of grade and other things. The overall tons going through are meant to be improving, so that'll pick up in the next 8 years of the mine life. But once they, you know, address this sort of dilution problem, they speak about improving the blasting techniques that'll lead to dilution improvements, and then the overall head grade improves. They should hit that, you know, 170 odd thousand ounces in the year for 2024, and then maintain that for the next 8 or so years. So we'll see if they can get that. They're obviously a bit below that, but they have spoken about ounces meant to be better next year. So we'll watch it closely and see if another potential bidder comes out of the woodwork somewhere.
We will, mate. We will, because yeah, with that offer rejected, it appears like it'll be on the boards for a bit longer than previously suspected.
Agreed. Now let's talk about the big one, Matty. Spartan.
Matt Michael, you've been bloody banging your head against a computer screen all day and you're like, I'm going in circles because you've been looking at Spartan.
I don't know. I went down a bloody, I'll get to why, but anyway, it's I've ended up in no better place. Right, the big news, Spartan raising just before the bloody director's special was about to go out this morning. The old Stockness monster delivered the goods. Spartan raising $80, fully underwritten.
Ding, ding, ding.
Jade, you're again. Still bloody living the dream. Bloody fully underwritten $80 raise. So you got a 47 mil insto placement and a 1-for-17 entitlement offer for 33 million, which is underwritten by Canaccord Euros and Sternship Advisors, which is, you would assume, the Ashanti Capital arm of it.
Yeah.
At 58 cents, 11.5% discount to last close. So it came out in the Euros Hartleys sort of deal sheet and everything, and it was in the AFR before that an existing shareholder will be
selling
down their stake. And we're thinking, but it said an existing shareholder from the
Gascoigne days.
Inherited from the Gascoigne days. So we're thinking, well, it's probably not Tembo. We're thinking maybe Delphi.
Well, I was thinking, oh, it must be Tembo because John Hodder stood down from the board, which to me signaled they wanted to sell down. Mm. And then, but the wording, you were right. The wording was like, you were like, nah, mate, it's got to be Delphi.
Got to be Delphi. But then in the Euros thing, it actually said it's for 56.9 million shares. And you look at the top 20, and that is the NRW holding. So, an interesting thing about that is that, like, so Gascoigne, I think when they went into VA back in 2019, I think Gascoigne owed NRW $32.7 million. So some of that debt was converted into equity, some of it, and they held 36.9 million shares from 2020 onwards. And then in last year's recap, part of that recap was 20 million shares were issued to NRW, and that's how they ended up with the 56.9. So,
and then obviously part of the settlement of everything, including the termination of that contract, I think – they've ended up with a bunch of equity, and there were some other terms of a settlement agreement in the prospectus when they relisted in 2013.
Yeah, I think they got paid a little bit of cash as well. So they looks like they've got their money back, it appears, maybe, and a tiny bit more. So good for NRW, you'd say. And I think they were an inactive shareholder owning 6% of Spartan. So I what's going to be really interesting, so considering you got 80 mil raise and then another 33 million worth of the NRW shares, so you assume the book is going to be built to 113 million to give the raise and then trade out the NRW holding. So be interesting to see who pops up on the register. So in the top 20 when it comes out in the annual report, or new substantial shareholders. So 5% of the shareholding to go substantial is $32 million at 58 cents. That's only 28% of that total book. So plenty of room for a new substantial to possibly come in. So I'll be,
that'd be a big bite though. Mm. I think, a lot of instos, they come in, but they'll come in with a raise like this. They'll come in with a $2 million bid, $3 million bid, those sorts of numbers. That'd be a giant bite. And you'd probably write Cornerstone by X when it subsequently comes out.
Yeah, looking at this top 20 I got here, I don't think Nero a holder anymore. There's 1832 and
1832 owns 6% in the presentation they put up today. They're already
substantial. Precision, they've got 10 million shares. So anyway, it'd be interesting to see if anyone pops up. No one might, but always might get a bit more colour in the annual report when it comes out.
What are they doing with the money, Matty?
What are they doing, Trav? Mate, I'll tell you what they're doing, and it makes me excited. They're fucking finally going underground. 38 million of the bloody dosh is going into the... They call it an exploration decline, but it will serve as the mining decline and vent infrastructure. So you can see here, I'll show the schematic. It's like it's a parallel decline. So the reason for doing that, like one's the travel way, which will be the main decline. The other will act as the return airway vent circuit. So you see those little cross cuts there, they'll be stockpiles initially, but you gradually break it through into each other. And when you get to the next one, you shotcrete wall the one behind it. This is what you do when you've got a real straight decline that isn't spiraling. Because when it's spiraling, you put your return air drives out and link them up vertically. But when there's no other real way to do it, if you're going straight and long without breaking something in from the surface. So this is, it's pretty common. And the jumbo's parked up half the time waiting for firing and bogging of one decline. So you get way better utilization having two faces on the go, and you can punch everything. Keep your vent, primary vent up to scratch the whole way down. So 2.2 kilometres of development to go in. So that'll be, and they'll be drilling 65,000 metres of diamond holes from that exploration decline. So look, if you apply 12 grand a metre for the development and 250 bucks a metre for the diamond drilling, that gives 26 bucks for the development and 16 bucks for the underground drilling. So add a bit on top for other infrastructure and the studies they're talking about. So that'll chew up most of that raise coin, plus the, the working cap, the buffer they got on top of it. So it'll take them to a point of a final investment decision, which will require obviously a further debt and equity package for the mill upgrade. And so that involves, we talked about it the other day, Simon Lawson gave a bit of colour on it on the webcast today. So you'll have a secondary cone crusher to go in, a tertiary cone crusher, so just essentially two to get then feed it into a ball mill, the thickener, the upgraded electrowinning circuit, and the gold room. More than likely a paste plant, I would assume, will have to go in as well. And then you've got the further pre-production underground development, though this exploration decline and the return airways and that gets them right to the start of the Never Never ore body. So a lot of the pre-production development is getting sunk via this raise. So they'll be pretty close. They'll be at the level to really start bloody punching it in. So I'd say definitely north of 100 million. They did mention they're not going to be doing any pit cutbacks or anything, because it's just going to be a underground feed. So that saves on that, that they're sort of pushing that whole open pit theory to try and fill a mill to the side, and they're going to try and make this a fit for purpose mill for 1 to 1.3 million ton of underground feed. So you look at all this, you're like, right, what can break this project? What don't we know yet? What are the things to look out for? And probably the big one is the metallurgy. I know there was comments saying Mr. Lawson was pretty positive on the metallurgy, but
positive on everything, Matty.
We don't, based on what we know so far, we need probably a bit. We've got pretty much all the colour we need on the flow sheet, but trying to get to that minimum 94% recovery they're aiming for, because if we look historically and look what we know so far, so the previous MET test work conducted in
May last
mid last year, I think it was, around then, June or something.
Yeah.
They said the Never Never material gave a 94% recovery over a 48-hour residence time in the leach tanks.
You don't want to leach it that long, do you?
Well, the question is, can they?
Yeah.
And because it didn't – I think when they do that initial test work, they don't usually disclose the grind size used for it and the amount of cyanide used to get those results. So
what I wanted to know. Yeah. Fresh off the stoitis back, I was like, wow, what's the grind size? What micron? Is this ground to bloody
what's the 10 microns consumption? But that usually comes out in the feasibility study. It'd be good to know it in those tests, of the test, but you'll see that in the feasibility study. Because looking at that, they're good. They're good MET results, but I cannot for the life of me, and this is where I've fucking wasted so much time today, figure out how they get the column I'll show here, the 92% CIL recovery. So if there is any METs out there that can give the formula how they've come up with these numbers on this table, let me know, because I've already asked a really bloody good MET and even he can't figure it out. So I want to know, unless they've applied some sort of recovery for the actual cyanide circuit one for that bit to get these, it's I don't know. But question is, will they actually be able to achieve – a 48-hour residence time, which they've done in the testing, because the original Dalgaranga plant, which is there right now, looking at the old Gascoigne feasibility study, was designed for a 19-hour residence time, obviously well under half of the needed for the 48-hour that was done in the MET testing. But those leach tanks and that circuit was designed for a 2.5 million tonne per annum mill. So if they are going to drop it to 1 to 1.3 and with those existing leach tanks and the addition of the thickener, which decouples it and gives a bit more residence time as well, it's actually a linear relationship for the residence time. So halving the throughput should double the residence time, which means with what they've got, they should be able to achieve that 48-hour residence time. So
mate, we there must be like a bunch of metallurgists like listening to us just thinking, you guys are bloody like doofuses trying to figure out this MET 101 stuff live on the potty in front of everyone. But mate,
well, if those people are listening, tell me how to bloody calculate that shit, because we can't figure it out.
Matty, I definitely feel like Mr. Lawson tuned in, because we did touch on Spartan in the episode we did on MET specifically last week, and I just felt listening to the call today that he was very eager to sort of point out some of these things, and he was putting on a great show about how it's not going to be an issue. I just had that sort of inkling. I'm not sure about you guys.
I reckon he copied everything I said. And here's another one that talking about hardness and about now that we're developing underground, I'm thinking, right, what if the ground's bloody hard? So Bellevue's got the hardness reputation. Yep. Now, looking at the fees study from Gascoigne back in the day, they had for the fresh rock under Gilbey's the bond ball work index of 13.4 to 17.4 for the ore,
yep,
which is – so I'll show you the table. Between 14 and 20 is classified as hard. Above 20 is classified as very hard. So for comparison, Bellevue's fee study had their ore around the 15 to 17 mark. And we know Bellevue is renowned for being very hard. So looking pretty similar hardness for the ore. From what I've heard, the waste is much harder at Bellevue than the ore is. Waste is everything outside the bloody ore body, all your capital infrastructure going in and your accesses. So it'll be interesting.
It sort of made sense as well, Matty, because Lawson said if you want to get a feel for what the flow sheet's going to look like, just have a look at what they're doing at Bellevue.
Yeah, yeah. So it'd be interesting to see what this waste development at Spartan's going to be like when they're if the ground's going to be hard everywhere, that because that obviously slows down the development rates for the jumbos, makes it very time consuming to put in your raised bores and costly, etc. For the ventilation. But the pro is having hard ore is good for control and dilution in the stopes and maintaining the head grade. So look, it can't be determined if when the ore is hard, the waste is going to be hard, and you can't even determine that if it was hard under the Gilbey's pit that it's going to be hard at Never Never as well. Like you don't know. But I'll tell you one thing that is usually true: if the ore is hard, the waste is even harder.
Mm.
That is, you know, I've drilled a couple of holes, and that's usually the bloody case. So yeah, a couple of comments from the webcast. They don't plan on drilling another 1,000-metre hole for Never Never, which bloody thank God for that, because that's bloody costs a lot of coin. So it looks like the definition at depth of Never Never is complete until they actually get the exploration drives in so they can actually drill from underground and drill less metres. And we mentioned about not doing a cutback just to fill the mill. So look, here's the questions, boys. What do you think? What they've done today, raising this big chunk, what does it mean for the Spartan stock and I guess maybe the companies that would be considering taking them over, if there's any?
Trav, you raised a good point earlier today, how it could in part be interpreted as a bit of a defense mechanism.
Yeah, in some ways,
You don't want to have to pay a premium on the cash, you know. It's sort of one way about going about it. And I think the other thing to bear in mind is the recent hire, Craig Jones, gives a bit of an indication, as you pointed out, Matty, that they're, you know, getting to that point where, you know, he might be the one who wants to build the new mill and get this thing actually mining.
Yeah, and I think we did flag that. It was an indication like, look, and I still think that might be, I'm leaning towards the fact that they will build this themselves, and Jonesy is the man to do that because he's got the decades of underground experience. Went through the process with Bellevue, and I reckon he'll want to put his bloody mark on this. And I would assume he'd become the MD eventually, and Lawson will transition out, and he'll be the one to actually drive this. So
I look at the was a pro forma market cap $641 million. Like, there's just some de-risk. I think it's de-risking to be done. If anyone pays a premium on that today, you've got to do a bit more de-risking to be comfortable. And I think there's both sides. There's upside because things could get better at depth, but then there's just risk with the met stuff that we talked about today. Like, that'd be, if anyone put in a bloody NBIO, hey, keen to bloody do mutual DD, can we do that? You know, a huge item of diligence is just going to be show us all of your met test work you've done today.
Yeah, and I think it's timing as well, because when we were talking about it last year, thinking like, because they could have put this underground decline in at any time and it would have been beneficial because they would have got more drilling done for cheaper on the drilling side. But look, this has to go in at some stage if they want to bloody mine it. But look back at what the landscape was like last year, highly inflationary environment. A lot going on. Since then, lithium slowed down. Nickel has really, really slowed down. So it's a bit of a client's market now with mining contractors. I reckon Barminco will be absolutely begging for this contract on the back of what's happened with nickel. So, you know, Panoramic, that went on care and maintenance. They had that contract. Cosmos has been put on care and maintenance.
Spotted Quoll and Flying Fox,
near the end and their nickel. The client has the power with pricing and things like that, because contractors want contracts more than they did previously. So they'll be in the mix. So I think the landscape's changed. I know he was talking about rates of a bit more appealing now for contractor rates. And look, it is probably a function of that, and like that translates into wages in the industry, because you know it's the rise and fall, and that's how it works. So, do you think they're going to build it themselves? If you're going to chuck a crystal ball on it,
I still say no. I say no, to be honest. I kind of think like I get the Craig Jones thing, but it's not like when you acquire a company, it's not like the team changes. You kind of keep the operators that are there who are familiar with the project and sort of, you know, have your integration of the people who are ops focused. I kind of think like it's the shiny new story in this Gold Bull run. It's like, it's, you know, the Bellevue of 2020, you know, like it's kind of got that shine to it at the moment.
That's why I think they're going to build it.
No, well, the thing with Bellevue is they were, and maybe it is the same, because Bellevue were always too good at promoting themselves, too fully valued, that even though it was a target, totally was a target, no one ever wanted to pay a premium on what the market was already valuing it, because
that's what these guys are.
Yeah, I mean, these guys don't lack promotion capability. They're right.
They've got shitloads of promotion. They've got a good valuation on the back of it. So
yeah,
I reckon it's identical to situation to Bellevue, that I don't think anyone's going to pay up for it.
Yeah,
possibly they might, but it's leaning to be a pretty similar journey, I think.
Yeah, I think it. It'll all hinge on how deals get done when you're desperate, you know, and like Ramelius missing out on Karora. How are they thinking about their growth profile when Penny runs out and things like that, you know? Those can really contribute to deal motivating factors. So
How good's gold? I love gold. I love metallurgy now. I love underground, and I love more undergrounds, because that means more DSI bolts getting in. Those bloody parallel, those twin declines going down are just going to be absolutely pristine, covered with some sensationally galvanised split sets and mesh. Hopefully they're just putting split sets in. If the ground's hard, they better not be putting bloody GUIs or MDXs in, because that's just a friggin' waste of money. Hey, but if you're going to give that money to anyone, you better give it to DSI, because that is the only bloody ground support that I want to see put in those Spartan declines.
Is it the contractor that chooses let's say Barminco get it. Is it Barminco that chooses the mesh and bolts that they use?
I think I'm going to be choosing it. I have chosen it. I've chosen it right now, and that's DSI going into the Spartan decline.
Yeah.
Well, JD, I think you put it out there. If it's not DSI, you're going to dump all your shares.
Mate, it's not just Spartan either.
DSI, anybody dump company shares immediately.
Yes.
The new slogan.
Righto. Get on board, bloody DSI. Love your work, DSI. Let's transfer commodities onto the red metal. Copper.
That's it, mate. AIC Mine. So they today came out with a combination of two things, their March quarterly results and an updated resource and reserve, LOEs. The market liked it. Stock was up 6% intraday, cooled down to about 3% up. But, you know, today I saw it trade at 12-month highs, which is, pretty positive for them. Eloise produced 11.6 thousand tonnes of concentrate in the quarter, which contained 3,000 tonnes of copper. Operating cash flow, 13.3 million, which is healthy. They put it back into the mine, of course, and so you got like a relatively neutral total change in cash. Remember, copper prices, they've continued to climb since the month ended, so the margins are going to improve. And the step change for AIC is going to be like Jericho in the near term. And also, let's see how Swagman pans out. They're going to put some holes into that. And initial grades look intriguing, right? Now, I don't own AIC Mines. I know JD's owned it in the past. He hasn't for about a year. And as I keep getting more and more tempted to play the copper theme, this is the ASX stock that keeps drawing me in. $200 million market cap, lots of mine life ahead, organic growth to lower unit costs with Jericho, lots of talk, sharp team, but I haven't bought it yet. I can't give you a good reason for that either. But I keep, it's like a magnet. I keep coming back and looking at it.
Agreed, mate. And lots to look forward to in this quarter in particular. We spoke not too long ago about financing and mine studies and plant upgrades that are all meant to be happening pretty soon. So watching with bated breath there.
Beautiful. Your Auntie Gina, what's Auntie Gina been up to, Trav?
She's been very busy, mate. Of course.
You're starting to develop a bit of an extended family on this show. I'm just putting it out there.
They're all friends of the show, but now you're making them relatives. She's been active, Gina, and it's really intriguing. I feel like I'm on Gina watch at the moment. But yeah, she spent, you know, like close to $50 million on Linus stock, and that disclosure of her being a substantial shareholder came, you know, just I think it was within a week of her emerging as a substantial shareholder of MP Materials, who's the only other, like, you know, rare earth producer of substance in the West. And of course, with merger discussions of those two entities being rife in the press in the past, the natural, like, conversation to have is Gina taking stakes in both to sort of, you know, encourage or entice an outcome of a merger. As a shareholder, you get some degree of influence, and the thing in the back of everyone's head is like, is that influence going to be encouraging of a merger of these two big players in the rare earth game who have multi-billion dollar market caps?
Yeah, I think we should chat and just sort of give our views, you know, between us, whether we think the deal makes sense. I did notice there was an AFR article with snippets from Mr. Ben Cleary, who we've had on the show from Tribeca, as well as James Stewart from Ausbil. Ausbil are across their funds substantial Linus holders. So Cleary was in favour of the deal, talking up that it sort of made sense, whereas Stewart sort of said that Linus didn't really need to do a deal at the moment. So there's heaps of different angles to talk about a potential deal. Obviously, like you said, Trav, the company's confirmed that they had previously been in discussions. That was not too long ago. Now they've got this mutual shareholder. For reference, just to help think about it, Linus is in Aussie dollars, $6 billion market cap. MP Materials, $4.5 billion market cap. They've come down a fair way, as has Linus. But in thinking about a potential deal, I mean, off the cuff, there's a bunch of different questions that pop into my head. You know, synergies, these companies are on, you know, other sides of the planet, but they do have some sort of common ground in Texas, and more, you know, common ground in the sense of building a monopoly ex-China business. And then you've got the fact that Shanghai is an 8.3% shareholder in MP Materials. Now, they've been there for a long time. They really provided technical support and helped MP Materials from a company that had a mine, Mountain Pass, that had sort of butchered it a number of times in the past when this sort of hedge fund came through and bought the asset for 20 odd million bucks, and now it's a $4.5 billion company.
Came to market via a SPAC. But the history of this one is a story of debt that sent that one cooked it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a fascinating sort of story there. And then the other sort of questions that pop into my mind is like, how would the Chinese groups react? You know, they obviously control the market, and they're pretty proud, if that's the right word, of this market. They're pretty determined in wanting to hold the control over the rare earths market that they have. And the last thing that pops into the head whenever you're talking about rare earths is the sort of strategic importance, and whether the government's, obviously we're allied here in Australia with the US, but would either government be happy with one company and one country being the owner of both those assets, or how would that kind of look? So keen to kind of hear your guys' thoughts on, I mean, whether this deal actually goes ahead, whether you think it happens, and whether that makes sense.
I reckon the odds of a deal have shortened dramatically when you see, yeah, a common shareholder pop up on both registers. I agree. And I think like a merger, if it were to eventuate, is actually a pretty, yeah, like if you're a shareholder of either of those companies, that I'd have a positive outlook as a result of that, because it's a market share thing. It's like, fuck, there's literally only two companies that meaningfully supply this product to the West, and it's these two companies. So heck, there's,
and beyond market share as well, they've had such government support. You know, from both Aussie and US governments, right? It's like it's almost like a defense business. You know, they obviously supply product for defense businesses in the States.
Both have received funding from the US Department of Defense in terms of some Texas facility development. There's probably some synergies around that, like you said, JD. I think it would become a story of like, I don't think the story of the pro forma, if they combined, would be a story of kind of, you know, having security of supply ex-China. I think if you've got the Shengi link in the pro forma, which you'd imagine remains, it's going to be a conversation of how do you work with China.
Well, absolutely. As another former guest, Kingsley Jones, pointed out, like, material still goes to China. And this is, you know, he honed in on the Linus angle, but MP Materials, the same sort of goes. That the nations are determined on building everything they can, cracking, leaching, the whole processing suite in country. But that's not the case at the moment. So, you know, you're gonna have to be friendly in the interim at least. And then there's another sort of question that comes out the back of it is, Gina's got that common shareholding, but she's also 5.8% shareholder in Brazilian Rare Earths, as well as a 10% shareholder in Arafura, which we spoke about recently, got a big free kick from, well, it's not finalized, but they got an $840 million free kick from the government. So interesting to kind of think about what her angle is in the rare earth space more broadly.
I think, do you think she's, from her point of view, if she's got shareholdings everywhere throughout these companies, she would rather these mergers, no, and not have to pay a premium herself and influence these mergers happening?
Well, Linus MP would be like a nil premium one. They're similar sized companies. You've got a common shareholder that would be encouraging minimum premium. Yeah. So that's your pathway to kind of seeing common ground on valuation, because you can get a combination done at no premium. I think, like, I'm not in the camp that thinks Arafura gets built. I still think that's hard.
Yeah.
You know, granted, there's that government support. It's still conditional. Don't know about that one. And then Brazilian rare earth stuff, it's still, that's a long way off, right?
Very early days. That's, yes, but hey, look how much the world's changed in the bloody year this potty's been going. Jesus Christ, it could change, imagine, in 2 years' time. Who the bloody hell knows what we're going to be talking about, boys?
Mate, here's an interesting thought for you too, right? Like, Gina is a character that we love to talk about because it's just fascinating. And in Australia, we love to hate her. We do. But if she's the major shareholder of the only, like, producer of rare earths in the West, all of a sudden we need her.
Mm.
That is a weird thought process. Like, wrap your head around that one. Imagine if we literally needed Gina. Crazy one. Ponder it.
One to chew on.
Oh, love it. Right, thanks to all the bloody partners, dude. We're having the show, boys.
Mate, there's one more. There's one more segment to cover.
Is there, JD? Jesus Christ, what have we got, Cobber?
The Gina drama doesn't end there. Just a quick one. She did a deal with Titan Minerals through her Han Ryan, that's a subsidiary of Hancock.
So there's Han Ryan, Ecuador. Han Roy, fucking Jesus Christ.
There's heaps of them, yeah. So, I mean, why I think this is interesting is we haven't really seen Gina. Obviously, she's gone into MP Materials, but we haven't seen her in the past do a lot of work in other countries outside of Australia. So what she's done here is a sort of classic earn-in and a sort of farm-in and JV with Titan Minerals. So they've got the Linderos Copper Project in Ecuador. So initially just $2 million for 5%, and then after that, 10 kilometers of drilling or $8 million spent gets them a further 25. This goes all the way through on various stages to either the decision to mine or total expenditure of $120 million, at which point Han Ryan would have 80% interest. Now, on the flip side, Titan, they'll be pretty chuffed when they come out of trading halt because they are free carried all the way through until that point at which Han Ryan is 80% owners. So obviously they're a small company, 45 million market cap before the announcement came out, and there's no guarantees of success. We've seen plenty of JVs and farm-ins happen in the past that haven't led to anything. But this Linderos project, super early stage, they're looking for a copper porphyry system out there in the south of Ecuador, but it was just one that had perked up. We spoke a couple months ago about Gina getting busy in Ecuador, and she's sort of following through now.
Mate, she's bloody all go. Sorry to cut you off, JD, when you got such bloody good stuff to rip out for the money miners, Cobb.
No dramas, mate. Couple of partners to thank now.
Speaking of partners, waiting for a spinner to drop off some bloody piss. They're still waiting on some dingo. God help me if I've got to buy it. Fucking hell. Who'd we have? Bloody Brooks Airways flying everywhere and everything around the country. Brooks Airways and DSI making the Spartan declines safe and possible. We've also can't forget our great mates at Verify, Get Wet Solutions, Silverstone. Silverstone will do the power for it, for sure. Anytime Exploration, WA Water Bores, and K-Drill. Oodaroo, Money Miners.
Oodaroo, Money Miners.
Oodaroo.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.